Daniel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, my name's Scott Daniel. I represent the appellants, Scott Blamer and Bell Fury Investments Group. The trial court found that my clients misrepresented a material fact and thus breached a contract with the appellees. With respect, the trial court was wrong in that. And in reaching that judgment, the trial court had to first and foremost find that a contract indeed existed between these parties. My client has disputed that from the outset, and we welcome the examination of the record in this case by this court, because I don't believe that there's any way that we can reach a contract or a meeting of the minds, which I think every case in Nebraska that I've read concerning the formation of a contract indicates that you have to have a meeting of the minds or a mutual understanding between the parties, and that the agreement and the terms must be definite and certain. That is clearly not the case in this case, and here is why. First of all, the appellee contended that his contract with my client was as follows. Number one, that we would provide research and assist him to become aware of how to do business as Bell Fury does business, which is to buy and sell distressed properties at foreclosures and trustee sales. Armed with that research, Mr. Ziegler then would identify properties that he was interested in, and that he would notify Mr. Blamer of his interest and identify to Mr. Blamer what his top dollar would be on those particular properties. And on those particular properties only then, Mr. Ziegler then would send Mr. Blamer to auctions as his agent to bid for him and only for him. And that if successful at the auction, that Mr. Blamer would either then buy the property for himself or that Mr. Ziegler would buy the property. And frankly, the record is unclear, and I'm not clear as to how that was to take place. I know how it did take place, but he testified both in his deposition and at trial differently on how that was supposed to take place. And lastly, Mr. Ziegler testified that the deal was that he was to acquire the property at the price that was bid at the auction. And that was the agreement. And my clients dispute almost all of that. And here is what the record reflected. First of all, the agency relationship. Mr. Ziegler claimed that we were his agent. And then at trial, both in his deposition and at trial, he indicated that we were not the buyer's agent. And indeed, after that, he testified that he was aware that Mr. Blamer represented other people at particular trustees' auctions. And for the purpose of acquiring property and reselling it to not only perhaps Mr. Ziegler, but others. And Ziegler was aware of that. And under those circumstances, he couldn't have been the exclusive agent of Mr. Ziegler, as he claimed and as he contends that's the contract that he had with.
So if it wasn't an agency relationship, what was it?
Here's what it was. Mr. Blamer agreed to help, at Ziegler's request, to help him learn how to buy and sell property, that he would provide the research, and that when he would go to the auction, if he was successful in obtaining the low bid on the property, he would then turn around and make it available to Mr. Ziegler at the price of Mr. Blamer's choosing. That was the deal. There wasn't any contract written. There wasn't any document that said, here's what our arrangement is to be. And indeed, Mr. Ziegler said in his deposition that it was an oral arrangement. And at trial, he said, no, it wasn't an oral arrangement. It's based on this wad of emails over the course of a year that we have. And that's our contract.
And Mr. Ziegler had a different version of what he thought the deal was. Aren't these just questions of fact? Are you asking us to just reweigh this?
Well, First of all, the issue of whether or not there was a contract or not is an issue of law, which is to be reexamined by this court on this record. And my suggestion is, I don't think there's any, other than the issue of the statute of frauds applicability, I don't think there's any issues of law here of case law that are in dispute. But there's plenty of issues as to how this court could find that a contract existed between these two people based on this record. Because if you look at the record, and we've cited all the instances in our briefs, is that there weren't any obligations on the part of either party. For instance, Mr. Blamer had no, and Mr. Ziegler concedes this, Mr. Blamer had no obligation to if he acquired a property at an auction, to indeed sell it to Mr. Ziegler if he chose not to. Conversely, Mr. Ziegler testified that he didn't have any obligation to buy a particular piece of property, is either he chose not to, or couldn't afford it, or didn't want to for whatever reason. There wasn't any obligation on part of either party, as he contended that there was a contract to do that, which leads to the final conclusion, is that his claim here, and his claim for misrepresentation, his claim for breach of contract, and his claim for damages, all centers around the obligation he says my client agreed to sell all these three pieces of property to him at the price that he acquired at the auction. There's nothing in the record that says that.
Does the record indicate, you keep saying that Mr. Ziegler's buying this from your client. Didn't your client, on the day the purchases were made, email Mr. Ziegler, who was then to forward the price, he was then paying that to your client's company?
Correct.
To go on, was your client's company ever even being named as a buyer, ultimately?
My client bought the property from the trustee at the trustee sale, correct.
Was there evidence of what the deed showed? When it's sold, who's the buyer and who's the seller? What's the evidence show as to who's the buyer and who's the seller? The seller is obviously the trustee, but who's listed as the buyer?
The trustee sold to Belfiore Investments Group.
So Belfiore is listed as the buyer.
Correct. And then Belfiore Investments Group sold to Ziegler at the price that he conveyed to him in those emails. Originally,
so the evidence would show two separate transactions.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It does. I would just make one other point, and I'll reserve the rest of my time. The statute of frauds, I would submit to you, applies. This is a case where Mr. Ziegler complains that we did not sell the property to him at the price agreed to, which to me is fall squarely within the statute of frauds.
They weren't entering into a uniform purchase agreement for the purchase of the property.
No, but involved. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, it appeared to me that Mr. Ziegler was just saying that your client was basically doing the legwork, but it was actually him purchasing it. So why would the statute of frauds?
The statute of frauds, I believe, applies because it involves the sale of land, and what we're down to because of that is a he said she said scenario as to what the deal was in regard to the sale of these properties, which is precisely what the statute of frauds was designed to avoid in real estate transactions. Thank you.
Mr. Ruby.
Your Honors, may it please the court. At a very high level here, there's really no question that there was a contract and that there was performance. It's just a question of, you know, what the terms of the contract were.
So where was the offer, the acceptance, and the consideration, and the meeting of the minds?
There's testimony that by Mr. Ziegler that Mr. Blamer would represent him at these auctions, that they had an agreement that he would represent him at these auctions, that he would charge him $3,000, if he secured a property, and that he was supposed to submit his maximum bid prior to the auction on properties that he identified based on research that Mr. Blamer had generated, that Mr. Blamer was then, if he was successful in bidding at the properties, Mr. Ziegler was then supposed to wire the money up to his maximum bid, and then the property would be Mr. Ziegler's. So that was the contract, according to Mr. Ziegler. He both testified to that orally, and I suggest to you that the emails are very telling in this case, that they actually support that testimony, and they run contrary to the version of the contract that Mr. Blamer puts forward. Mr. Blamer testifies that, yeah, basically all that's correct, except that I was going to buy the property that he identified for my own account, and then inconsistently testifies that he would sell it to Mr. Ziegler for 60% of the assessed value. He contradicts himself in one part of the evidence on that, says, no, I never said that. And another part, he says, yeah, that's how I would determine it, 60% of the value. There's no evidence of any discussion between Mr. Blamer and Mr. Ziegler as to, you know, what the price would be if Mr. Blamer purchased the property for Belle Fury and then turned around and sold it to my client. There's nothing in the written evidence to that effect.
When your client wired the money, was it wired to Belle Fury?
It was, with an additional fee for a wire to the trustee.
Were the emails contested?
No, they were accepted into evidence. Yeah, and one of the early emails, if you look at, you know, page 17 of my brief, this is one of the early emails. Mr. Blamer tells Mr. Ziegler, if you want to bid, I'll need your range slash upper limit instructions, plus a good number at which I can contact you with results. Plan on having cash ready to wire by late morning if you are successful. That's an early email, you know, prior to these actual successful purchases. What's also interesting too is that at least in two transactions, we have written emails where Mr. Ziegler, the day, either the morning of or the day before the actual auction, submits his quote maximum bid. And in both of those cases, Mr. Blamer comes back right after the auction and says, congratulations, you're successful at your maximum bid. Okay. It's not at 60% assessed value. It's you're successful. He talks about the bidding and how it was competitive, and how the property is yours at the maximum bid. In both the Lafayette property and on the 34th Street property, there's conflicting tests. Mr. Ziegler testified on the 18th Street property that he authorized a maximum bid, and that Mr. Blamer contacted him after the bid and said, you know, well, it's yours, you want it. Mr. Blamer testifies that no, that communication came in, you know, after we had purchased. In other words, Mr. Ziegler didn't talk to me until after the bidding process had concluded. So there was conflicting testimony on the 18th Street property. But the court obviously believed Mr. Ziegler on the 18th Street property. And on the other two properties, the email exchange is very telling.
Well, you have time. I want to get into this issue of damages here. So the proper measure of damages in a fraud case like this is putting the party in the position they would have been but for the fraud. Would you agree with that?
I would agree.
And under the damage award in this particular case, doesn't the damage award have to be reduced by the sum of at least $3,000 for each transaction? Meaning if you paid the $46,000, Blumer did all this work and this service for nothing.
Well, we do not ask for the $3,000 back as part of the $41,000 $729. Okay, the numbers are a little confusing because the pleadings asked for $46,000 and some change. But I think if you actually get into the weeds of the evidence, the actual difference in purchase price as represented, the actual price that Mr. Blamer represents was paid for the properties at the bidding, and what was the actual purchase price. If you look at the actual documents, the amount comes to $41,729, and I do talk about that in my brief. But so we're asking for that difference, which I think goes to your measure of damages, but we're not asking for the $3,000 per transaction that was paid to Belfuri. That was paid in addition to the purchase price for those properties. Now,
isn't that inherent in the judge's award currently, the $3,000 per property?
I don't think so. I think what the judge did was he went solely by what was pled as the difference in purchase price. If you look at the amounts that are in his order and you compare that against the amended complaint, I think those the difference in purchase price on each property match up, and if you total those up, they come to $46,000 some odd dollars. I don't think the judge awarded $3,000 per transaction. That was paid for Belfuri to represent Mr. Ziegler at these purchases.
So are you saying then that the 41,000 figure is the correct amount as opposed to the 46,000 figure?
I think it is, Your Honor. I hate to admit it, but
I appreciate your frankness.
Yeah.
So, and then what about the $5,000? Apparently, what is it, the 34th Street property that apparently he didn't acquire at auction directly instead because he didn't acquire it. He paid right. An additional $5,000 to have the property assigned to
right.
him, correct?
Right.
So that should be also included as it relates. I mean, is the judge's award currently include that $5,000 in your mind?
It does not include that $5,000. It does not reduce the award to us by that $5,000.
Should it?
I don't think so. I don't think the judge believed that. I mean, all the judge awarded... there was quite a bit of testimony at trial on that very issue. For the first time, it came out. It wasn't disclosed in discovery. We didn't have any of these documents about, you know, checks or an assignment or anything about this $5,000 that was supposedly paid. And then it comes out at trial that, oh, by the way, I didn't, contrary to what I represented in the email to you about you winning the bid, I got there late. And I had to buy it from these two other people that had bought it, which is odd in itself, two other people. And I had to pay $5,000 for an assignment of that purchase that had already occurred from the trustee.
Right.
And
but they did produce, what, two $2,500 checks the second day of trial as it relates to that?
They did. Those checks are dated a week after the sale to two different entities on two different days.
They coincide with the evidence with regard to who purchased it?
No, there's nothing tying those checks to this property other than Mr. Blamer's oral testimony. And he didn't even produce a copy of the assignment.
You didn't have any evidence to refute it. It's just the question of whether or not the judge believed that they actually paid an additional $5,000 and didn't buy it themselves at auction.
And obviously the judge didn't believe it.
Okay.
So the... There is plenty of, you know, there was talk about, you know, how can the court believe that Mr. Blamer was only going to represent Mr. Ziegler. Mr. Ziegler testified that he had discussions with him, Mr. Blamer, about this very issue, that he liked it for the hunt, and that he always was only concerned about the $3,000. So there is testimony there. As to why Mr. Blamer would be doing this for just $3,000 versus taking the properties on his own. We don't exactly know what the judge was thinking when he ruled in my client's favor, but it seems to be a no-brainer Mr. Blamer was going to defraud my client. He gets, if he can get the maximum bid from my client, he's pretty safe bidding in on these properties, and can just call my client. If he wins the bid, can call my client and get the money. So there are explanations for why there are explanations for why he would only be bidding for him at these auctions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rudin. And how much time did we have left for rebuttal?
45.
All right, 45 seconds. Mr. Daniel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think the judge, I think the numbers are wrong in regard to the $3,000 in our brief explains that. In addition, even if you believe that there is, or conclude that there is a contract here, the contract that Mr. Ziegler would come to my client in advance of a hearing or advance of a sale, give a maximum price, and go forward that way, on two of these occasions that didn't occur. On the 18th Street property, he actually came back and at Mr. Ziegler asked my client after he had already been to the auction, he asked, is it still available? He clearly had not come to him in advance to do this, to do that transaction. That's not within his contract.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Daniel. Thank you very much, counsel, for your arguments. The case will be taken under submission, and you're excused, and we are adjourned.